and you feel crushed, right? If it doesn't get communicated properly, if it doesn't express properly, then you feel like you just put yourself out there and you felt flat as a belly flop. So I'm very nervous about this. That's point number one I want to make. Point number two is that my personal educational philosophy, not that I really have the right to have one, I've barely been educating for just a little bit, but my personal educational philosophy is that everybody can handle substantive things. What we're going to do tonight for the next hour is not cute ideas. It's not, oh, why do we get drunk on Purim? Let's talk about why Purim is so happy. Let's talk about how we have faith with vorts and cute ideas. This is serious. This is serious stuff. It's serious, substantive, intellectual, and meaningful and emotional things we're about to talk about. And to do that properly, I need people to be acting on a level of maturity and a level of substance, of sophistication, of paying attention in a real way, both with your mind and your heart, and full attention. Because we're moving fast, because what we're doing tonight really is actually an Emunah workshop that I'm trying to build to be able to give eventually later on in my life, God willing. And it's a series of tons of shiur. And what we're doing tonight is a tiny, tiny little drop in this huge ocean of material on this mahal that I want to give over. But we're going to do a little bit of it tonight. And aside from being nervous, I'm super excited. I'm really excited. The nervousness is holding me back a little bit from being as excited as I want to be. But I'm really excited to do this with you tonight. Because this is really huge stuff. Huge, huge stuff. Game-changing, life-changing. One more point of introduction is that for some of you, I venture a guess that some of what we're going to be talking about tonight might not be entirely relevant right now. That might be a terrible introduction to a shiur, okay, so why are you talking about it to us, right? It might not be 100% relevant in your life right now, but do me a favor and listen with full concentration, because I am very confident that for almost all of you, at some point, this will be excruciatingly relevant. This will be painfully relevant. This will be extremely, extremely relevant, probably more than almost anything else, if I could be that bold and brazen, and that you'll hear in the topic of Emunah talks, of talks about why we believe in what we believe about faith. This is super relevant. Maybe not right now. For some of you, it might be right now. For some of you, it might be in a year from now. It might be in 2 years. It might be in 5 years, 10 years, 25 years. But this is super relevant. So please pay attention, even if at some point you feel like tuning out. My last point of introduction, who am I? So I'm very fortunate to know many of you. From intramurals and from the base medrash, from learning, from Fabrangan together, from Shiram together. But for anybody I haven't met yet, so you might know me from Danishes, from Justin, but if you don't know me from that, then you don't know me from other things. So my name is Yaakov Danishevsky. I'm learning the Greskola. I have the unbelievable privilege to learn together with you guys. And this is just going to sound like random bits of information, but you'll see as I go on why I'm telling you this. My background is, I love learning Gemara. Gemara is one of my favorite things in the world to do. I love learning Gemara. It's beautiful, it's stimulating, it's rich, it's deep, it's profound, it's exhilarating. I also love philosophy. I love Jewish philosophy. I majored in college in Jewish philosophy. I minored in philosophy. I have a master's in Jewish philosophy. I love studying philosophy, intellectual works. I love it. It opens my life, opens new doors, new vistas, new ways of thinking about things, and I love it. So I just say it by way of introduction. You'll see why as I go on, why I offer those random bits about myself to you. So the shiur tonight, it's called Losing Your Mind Rationally. Foundations of Faith for a 21st Century Jew. We're going to focus on Emunah, on faith, why we believe what we believe, certain principles and foundations to faith, to believing what we believe as Jews, and with a focus on Purim. We're going to be talking a lot about Purim, in the beginning and the end. The middle is going to be about Emunah, but you'll see how we get back to Purim. I want to give us all, I know many of us, I've been talking to one of their bam here earlier this afternoon, many of us plan on getting drunk on Purim, maybe very drunk, a couple of us maybe don't. So one of their bam said to me, okay, it's good that someone's finally giving a shiur on how to get drunk, not why not to get drunk, because everyone's getting drunk anyway. So hopefully I'm doing that, and hopefully I'll give you something very real and very deep. It's not just a day of the year that God just gives us like a permission to do what we really want to do the whole rest of the year. Just like one day, here's a freebie. Here's a, you know, pass, go. No, it's not that. There's something very deep. There's something very real here. It's a real avoda. And the message, the meaning, the profound idea that's communicated through the day of drinking, of intoxication, is very deep. And I want to talk about that. So here we go, okay? Here we go. what in the heck is this guy doing over there? This guy, why is he so happy, first of all? And like, you know, we love him. He's so cute. I'm trying to give him a hug all the time because he's just devout. And the unbelievable Schluss of Learning Martin said to him, it's beautiful. Why is he so happy? Can he put his arm down a little bit? I'm sure it smells really bad over there. It's just, it's awesome. So the Gemara in Megillah teaches us, Amar Rav, Machayev initially besumei b'puraya. A person is supposed to get intoxicated with wine on Purim, ad lo yada, until he gets to a point where he doesn't even know the distinction between Ar Haman, Levarach Mordechai, the distinction between the fact that Haman is cursed and Mordechai is blessed. What is this all about? Like we just said, it's not just a day in the year that you get a free pass, you could just get drunk, go have a party, and do what you really want to do the whole rest of the year. Today you could do that. No, that's not what it is. It's something very deeper, something very profound. What is it that's being taught to us by Chacham? Second question about Purim. Purim is a day of Emunah. It's a day of reinforcing, reaccepting our relationship with God, with Judaism. We know the famous Gemara in Shabbos, Amar Rabba, Afal Pichin, that Rabba says even though they accepted the Torah at Har Sinai, and even though they had a sort of safety valve, they were able to get out of it. We're not getting into what that means right now. But then comes Purim, comes the miracle of Purim, Hadar Kibluha B'Me'ach HaShverosh. They reaccepted God. They reaccepted the relationship they had with God through Torah, through Yiddishkeit, on Purim. Dechsiv Kimu V'Kiblu HaYehudim. The Jews reestablished and reaccepted Kimu Masha Kiblu Kfar. They reaccepted Purim. They reaccepted Torah, reaccepted the relationship with God on Purim. What is this reaccepting? What is this reinforcing of Emunah? Excuse me, what is going on here? Why is this a day of Emunah? Next question. Who is our enemy on Purim? Everybody knows. Haman. Who is Haman a descendant of? Who is an expression of, a manifestation of? Amalek. Amalek is the arch prototype enemy of the Jewish people. The antithesis of Judaism is Amalek. What is the gematria of Amalek? The Sfarim teach us two different gematrias, the same gematria. Safek and Ram. What does Safek mean?
Doubt.
Good. What does Ram mean? Anybody know?
Haughtiness.
It means to be elevated, to hold yourself higher than something. What is the connection between Safek, doubt, and haughtiness? Why would Amalek be equal to those two gematrias simultaneously? What does that teach us? What does that mean to us? What do we make of that? Next. I'm just curious to know where we're holding. Okay? Well, Molly left? Yeah? Okay. Just, we can have a little fun. Pass it around. Take a little bit if you want. So, what is, oh, you're here? what's going on here? What do we got? Oops. Okay. So I'm just curious to know where we're holding people. Where are we holding on questions in terms of what I start off with, the fact that some of you might be a little bit more relevant for? Bring it back, Tavra. You bring it back. Where are we holding? How many people here would say they have questions of faith? Questions of faith. Don't be scared. Maybe everyone close your eyes and no one's embarrassed. Is that weird for people to do? I don't know. Whatever. People, raise your hands if you have questions. If I had more hands, I'd put them up. I have a lot of questions. Yeah, people have questions. It's not a problem if you don't. Totally good if you do. Totally good if you don't. Questions? I'm curious. Questions. Put them up one more time. Sorry, one more time. Okay, now, on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the most severe. Okay? 10 being the most severe, 1 being the least severe. 10 being the most severe, 1 being the least severe. How many people feel that the questions hold them back from the type of religious lifestyle they would like to lead? Listen closely. How many people... Everyone's listening? How many... You can pass it around. Just take a little bit, though. It's strong. How many people... Yeah, you got it. How many people feel that these questions inhibit and hold them back from the type of religious life they would like to leave on the level of severity between 8 and 10? Are people following my question? Anybody that's still listening? I pass out a little bit of water and everyone goes crazy. Lost the whole crowd already. It's like trying to say Dvar Torah on Purim. What, on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the most severe, how many people feel that their questions that they have hold them back from having the type of religious life and experience they would like to have, between a level of 8 and 10, 10 being the most severe, 1 to 10. Between 8 and 10, how many people? Raise your hands. Okay, a few. How many people feel that their questions hold them back on the severity of 5 to 7? Okay, a lot more. Okay, cool. Very interesting. Okay, I'm just curious to know where we're holding. So a lot of people have questions. For some people, it just makes them wonder. Some people, it just makes them wonder a little bit more. Some people, it drives them into rage and they go crazy. They can't continue life. I have a lot of questions. I know a lot of friends of mine who have a lot of questions. I know a lot of adults, a lot of kids, younger people, a lot of questions. Questions are a real thing. They exist. We have to figure out a way to approach emuna that we can handle these questions. That we can handle these questions. So what I want to do with you tonight is explore a whole new side, a whole new perspective, an entirely fundamentally, radically different approach to approaching the world of human reasoning, of questions and answers, of proofs, of trying to know when to believe things, know when not to believe things. I want to give you an entirely different way of looking at it. Turn your world upside down, literally. Okay? So here we go. We are influenced, I think everybody here, it's safe to say, is influenced by two very, very powerful influences. Again, listen closely, guys. The stuff I'm saying here, you have to listen closely. Almost every single point I'm making is important and requires attention. We are influenced by two primary, very powerful influences in our lives which create a certain reality for us. Not even a certain mindset, not a certain opinion, but literally a reality which just all encompasses us, envelops us, makes us think so strongly in this reality that we don't even know that it's not necessarily the only reality that exists. It's so powerful that we don't even realize that it's there. That's how powerful it is. What is that reality? That is the reality of intellect, of logic, of questions and answers. We function through our minds. We are mind people. We are thinking people. We want to think for ourselves. We want to understand something. We believe when we have reason to believe. We don't believe if it sounds stupid to us. We function in a world of smart and stupid. Makes sense, doesn't make sense. That is where we exist. That is our reality. That's the playing field. And that comes from two very strong influences. The first strong influence is the modern part of modern orthodoxy. What do I mean by that? What I mean by that is that most of us are from communities that, as the Pew study in 2013 reported, American modern orthodoxy is the best educated and has the largest high income earners of any Jewish denomination. We live in societies and groups of people where you're supposed to become a lawyer, a doctor, an accountant, a businessman, something in economics. You're supposed to be something which you have to do very well in school on. And what type of school? You have to do very well on standardized tests. You have to get good grades in classes. You have to perform on an intellectual level. That is where we are influenced. There's very little else that's influencing us in our schools. Maybe there's a little sports, maybe a few people play some music, but we are influenced that what makes or breaks your success is the profession that you are able to achieve. And that is determined and governed by how well you do in black and white schooling, in standardized testing, in very black and white type subjects, very linear things. That's the influence number one. Influence number two is the orthodoxy part of modern orthodoxy. In our communities, for better or for worse, I would say largely there are downsides to this, largely there are positive things to this, but I think there are major downsides which need to be addressed, and one of them is the following. The Judaism part of our lives is so heavily influenced by intellect. Intellect is the thing that's Jewish. What do you do when you want to do something frum? You go to a shir. What's the shir usually on? Intellectual subjects. On Gemara. Gemara is what we do. What is Gemara? Gemara is questions and answers and proofs and cheshbonos and thinking back and forth and going in and out. It's all these complicated stuff which is totally governed by human reasoning. It's supposed to be. Lo b'shamayim, the Gemara says about itself. Gemara is not supposed to be something beyond human intellect. It's governed. It is 100% through and through human intellect. That is what Gemara is. And most of our religious lives until this point has been an exposure to that type of religiosity. And very little else exists. So the confluence, the convergence of these two powerful forces of the professional ambition, of high income earners, of subjects and standardized testing, which is black and white, which is linear, which is all governed by intellect, and the orthodoxy part, which is so heavily intellectual, so heavily Gemara-oriented, or interesting, insightful ideas-oriented, or an analysis of a story in Tanakh, but it's intellectual, converge on us and create a reality in which we know nothing but using our minds. We don't even, you guys probably don't even realize, like, what is this guy even trying to say? Because it's just so ingrained in us that it's like almost like there's no other option, that it's, I'm not even saying anything. That's how powerful these forces are. They take us over, they create our reality. What I want to show you is that that's not true. That shouldn't be the case. That's not how we should live our lives. Human intellect is a very powerful thing. It's very important. Very important. Talmud Torah is a very important thing. That's why I started off talking about that introduction of myself. I love learning Gemara. I love studying philosophy. But we're taught... Where's Stein? You happy now? So, the intellect reasoning is just one of many tools. That's the sentence of this talk tonight. Listen close to that. Human reasoning, the human mind, is one of many tools. But it's just one tool. It's a very important tool. It's a powerful tool. It's a fundamental tool for any Jewish person. But it's just one tool. And I'm going to explain what that means as I go on. If you look at the spheros, what are the spheros? We're not getting into this, is not the topic at all. But the spheros are the different qualities through which God manifests himself into this world to give way to the world as we know it. This world is a multiplicity of characteristics, of different aspects of different things in life, of different qualities, different skills, different abilities, different capacities, all these different things in the world. And they come into being, this multiplicity, this variety of different things in this world, come into fruition, come into being, through the fact that God channels his light, which is really at its source one light, but channels his light through different energies, through different spheres. And that's called the spheros. Okay, at the most unbelievably simplistic level. All I'm trying to get at, to show you here, is that one of these spheros, one of these rays of light, of the many rays of light, one of the rays of light is called Bina, over here. Bina is a very high level. It's a very powerful level. It's a very important level. But it's just one ray of light. And that is the ray of light of human reasoning, of intellect. Bina is the world of questions and answers, the world of intellect. But that's just one ray of light. It's just one tool, one of many. All these different emanations, these different rays of light, bring into the world a multiplicity, a variety of beautiful and important and sublime and lofty capacities in this world. And we are all stuck right here. We are stuck right here. And we're missing out on all this other stuff. That's step number one. You with me? Everybody's with me? Step number two. Who's the, it's a good way because it's on the page, but who's the chief, most famous, influential Jewish philosopher? Rambam. The Rambam. The Rambam himself brings us to our next point. The Rambam himself brings us to our next point, which is that not only, listen closely, step number one that we just spoke about is that the intellect is one of many tools. Step number two is that this tool is extremely limited. What do I mean by that? The Rambam himself speaks about this. He writes that there's many things, many objects of perception which are within the scope of its nature, meaning the mind can understand certain things. On the other hand, there are amongst things which actually exist certain objects which the mind can in no way and by no means grasp. There are certain things in this world which exist, and they actually do exist, which the mind cannot fathom, which the mind cannot understand. The mind is a limited tool. It's a very ironic thing. People don't really always remember this. The Rambam, who's the biggest rationalist, the biggest proponent of think, and everything has to make sense in the tradition of Judaism. What was his biggest contribution? The Rambam's biggest contribution in the world of Jewish philosophy, not getting into the debate of the Rambam as a Talmud Chacham versus a philosopher, what's the Rambam's biggest contribution in the world of philosophy, of Jewish philosophy? It's negative theology. We're not getting what that is, but in one sentence, the Rambam's biggest contribution in the world of Jewish philosophy is that we cannot understand God. And not only we are so far from understanding God. We are nowhere near understanding God. We are fundamentally in a different place that we have no potential to understand anything ever at all about God. That's his biggest contribution. The Rambam, chief rationalist, his biggest contribution is the fact that the human mind is actually severely handicapped. It's severely limited. That's the Rambam's biggest contribution. Now I want to try and show you how limited it actually is. And this is just going to be humorous because it's so utterly absurd how much weight we give the human mind and at the same time how severely limited the human mind actually really is. And I want to show this to you through philosophy itself. Okay, I'm going to give you a very brief history of philosophy and show you philosophy's self-destruction. We're okay? People are with me, still happy? I wish I had another trick to pull out of my bag to get some more life to this. Okay? So, Let's look, okay? So the history of philosophy. Imagine for a second that these people in a cave, okay? In a cave, chained to the ground, with their backs facing, listen closely, their backs facing the entrance to the cave. And they can't turn around, okay? They can't turn around. I'm sitting in a cave right now. I'm chained to where I am. I cannot turn around. And behind me is the entrance to the cave. And I've been living here, planted, rooted in this spot, chained in this spot for the entirety of my life. Looking right in front of me. Right in front of me is a wall. On this wall, I see images. I see images. So my whole life, what do I know? I know these images. I think these images are real. I think these images are reality. I don't know any other reality. I think these images are real life. But what's really going on? So look at this picture here. It doesn't come out so clearly. Here's the people sitting on the floor in the cave. Here, and they can't see anything behind them. Here's the images. But really, these images are just people behind them holding up things to the light, and it's just the shadows of real existence. Right? Chop this? So they're not actually seeing anything but shadows. So this is the famous allegory of Plato. Plato gives this allegory, this analogy, and his point he's trying to prove, and this is the foundation of all philosophy. The foundation of all philosophy is this point, is that if you just trust what appears to be reality without actually thinking, without actually examining, without actually inquiring, you just go with what seems through your sensory experience, what seems to be reality, you're going to be totally lost and you're going to be totally off. Just like these people thought this is real reality, and in essence, it's just shadows. And this is the real reality. But if you don't inquire, if you don't have a philosophical mind, if you don't use human reasoning, if you don't think for yourself, you will be just like these fools sitting down here. To study philosophy is to become enlightened and walk into the light of actual reality, of thinking for yourself, not just buying into tradition, not just giving into experience, but thinking as a human being. That's the start, the foundation of philosophy. Now let me show you why that crumbles in 1 second, literally in 1 second. There's a famous idea in philosophy, a famous concept called the problem of the criterion. So it goes like this. Okay, we accept Plato's allegory. So now we want to think for ourselves a little bit, right? We want to think, we don't want to just give in to tradition, you know, this idea that God appeared and passed things down, the Greek mythology. We don't want to just give in to that. We don't want to just give in to our sensory experience. We want to actually think for ourselves. We want to be enlightened people. So let's start thinking. What should we believe? What shouldn't we believe? So what's the first step? We want to figure out what should we believe? What shouldn't we believe? How do we start? Okay, we want to be totally, rigorously, through our own reasoning. We don't want to give in to any of the pulls of tradition and assumptions or experiences. We want to be thoroughly honest through our intellect. Where do we start? Let's do it. Where do we start? So we have to start by figuring out how we determine what is true and what is false. We have to have a way of determining what we should believe. It's very simple. I'm not saying anything fancy. We have to have a way of determining what we should believe, what we shouldn't believe. Okay, good. So now let's figure out how we figure out what it is to use to determine that. That was a horrible sentence. Now our next step is we have to figure out a method to determining truth and false, right? What we want to do is figure out false and true. But we have to have a way of determining true and false. So what do we need? We need a way to determine how we can determine true and false. Is it making sense to people? Look here. Seemingly, we need some way of testing truth. Right? We need a test. A test will bring us to know what is true and what is not true. Okay, so how do we establish the test? Right? Everyone's following this? We need to establish the test. So how do we establish the test? Seemingly, we need to measure the test against a few examples of true and false, right? If I have a few examples of true and false, and now I can figure out through that a test, then I can take that test and apply it to other things. Make sense? I can take that test and apply it to other things. What's the problem? The problem is we don't know yet what's true and false. Are you following this? We don't know yet what's true and false, so we can't figure out a test. We can only figure out what's true and false if we have a test. But we can't figure out a test if we don't know what's true and false. So we're stuck, right? We're totally paralyzed. We can't move. We're in an endless circle, going around and around, trying to figure out where to start. And we can't even start. If you want to be thoroughly rational, thoroughly, I am in control. I'm not giving into any of the petty tradition, into the petty beliefs of religion. I'm not giving into any of the petty ideas of sensory experience, of just giving into my own thoughts. I don't want to be sitting on the floor of the cave looking at these shadows and thinking they're real existence. No, I want to understand things myself. You can't even take one baby step. You can't move. You're stuck in your place. If you don't want to make any assumptions, if you want to think entirely for yourself, you're going round and round and round in a circle. You can't even make one step. You can't go anywhere. So philosophy, in essence, self-destructs. We're not going to go through other examples. We could go through many. But basically, any topic you want to do in philosophy, you're going to get totally stuck. You know what I mean? You want to prove memory? Like, how do we know we should trust our memory, right? So anytime you try and prove memory, you're going to be using your memory to prove your memory, right? So you can't do that, right? I mean, we could go through all these things, and I'll show you how none of them make any sense. You're going to totally just crumble to the ground the second you start actually thinking about things. So the human intellect is a lot more limited than you might have thought. I want to give one more example of this. Because people often think of science as sort of the parallel opposite, the contrast to religion. What do I mean by that? Religion is something which is a leap of faith. It's a belief. It's not something that's proven. It's not something that's definitive. It's something that I believe. Someone taught it to me. I had a nice experience. I think it's meaningful. It gives me a purpose. I believe it. It's a leap of faith. Science is something which is 100%. Science is proof. There's a scientific method, a hypothesis, an experiment, induction. But thankfully, there was once a brilliant Scottish philosopher named David Hume, and he published this piece which literally just pulled the carpet from underneath science and showed that science is entirely a leap of faith as well. Science is no more 100% provable than any other experience that you have. Science is a leap of faith. And take my word for this, we're not going to go through it. No philosopher has ever been able to answer David Hume's problem. It's an unbelievably simple problem. We're not going through this whole thing, don't worry. It's an unbelievably simple problem. But nobody has ever been able to answer it. The honest philosophers have concluded that there is no answer, and they just agreed with him. His proof is basically, in one sentence, the following. If you want to space out for 30 seconds, this is the time, and I'll tell you when to come back in, okay? Don't take out your phones, but space out. Take a little break. In one sentence, here is his point. His point is like this. There's no reason why to begin with. If I had never experienced the fact that when I let go of this knife, it falls, I wouldn't have been able to assume that if I let go, it'll fall. I mean, let's say you take a person who's never existed before, but is a thinking person, not a child, a thinking, smart person. They've never seen anything in this world. This is an impossible scenario, but they've never experienced anything. You give them this knife, and you tell them, let go. What do you think will happen? They will have no idea. There's no more reason to assume it'll fall than the fact that it'll stay in the air, that it'll go up. We only think it'll fall because we've experienced that so many times. Now, that being said, okay, so what do we say? We say, yeah, but the fact that I experienced it every single time, so now I know it's going to happen next time. What gives you the right to make that jump? Who says just because I let go that time it fell, that means that now, the next time I fall, it's going to also, the next time I let go, it's going to fall also? Who says? Why is that a logical jump? Gravity. Who says gravity was in the past? Who says gravity is in the future? Would there be any internal contradiction to the world if gravity was but isn't in the future? The only reason there would be an internal contradiction is if you assumed that gravity had to be so. Like 1 plus 1 equals 2 had to be so. Before you experienced the experience of finding that 1 plus 1 equals 2, you could have known that 1 plus 1 equals 2 to begin with. But you couldn't have assumed gravity. There's no reason that gravity should have existed. So why would it be a contradiction if it was, but it's not in the future? We're not getting into this, but that's the basic point. The basic point is unbelievably simple. You have no reason to do induction, which is the scientific method. The fact that it happened in the past, who says it's going to happen in the future? It goes through a much more complex presentation of what I just said. But that's the basic point, and there is no answer, I promise. There's actually just no answer. There is no answer. You should try, but there's no answer. Now, the upshot of all of this, is that the human mind is something very powerful, something very valuable, something we should use, but it's just one tool. It's just one tool. And it's a tool which is extremely and severely limited. It has major weaknesses. It can't get very far if you want to actually be perfectly honest about it. But we give reasoning, we give the world of questions and answers a lot of punch. We give it a lot of power, a lot of validity. And that comes from a certain arrogance. That comes from a certain arrogance. Not an arrogance that means you're a bad person because you're an arrogant person. For many of us, it's actually entirely subconscious. But it comes from a certain arrogance that we think that the whole world has to be functioning, can only exist if it's able to be comprehended by our little brains. It's like, imagine this, you know, this huge, you know, you have this little dot here. That's called, you know, the person, and that's his little mind right there, mind, okay? Now you have this huge universe with a zillion things going on, all these things going on, millions of things going on, all these forces and all this stuff, and it's filled endlessly with so many things, and it really is more worlds and more worlds and more worlds and eternities and universes. And there's all this stuff going on all around this little, silly, foolish, tiny little guy. That's us, right? That's us in this universe. But we think that all of this can only exist and can only be in as much as this little pea brain is able to understand it. And that's an arrogance. That arrogance comes from the fact that I need to be able to understand everything. It revolves around me. I need to understand it. And this is what one of the great philosophers, German philosophers, Nietzsche, actually says in the following. That's a really cool move I just did, but very slow, so sorry. So he says like this. He gives the exact same mushal I just said. I actually stole it from him. Once upon a time, in some out-of-the-way corner of that universe, which is dispersed into numberless twinkling solar systems, this huge expanse, this enormous eternity of existence, there was a star upon which clever beasts invented knowing. This little, silly little human being came up with this concept of the fact that I have to be able to understand all the myriads of eternities of things going on around me. And Nietzsche says that was the most arrogant and mendacious, I don't know what that means, minute of world history. One might invent such a fable, and yet he would still not have adequately illustrated how miserable, how shadowy, transient, how aimlessly arbitrary human intellect looks within nature. Think about how ridiculous it is that this little thing thinks it can understand everything going on around it. And if it can't understand it, must not be so. It is human, and only its possessor and begetter takes it so solemnly as though the world's axis turned within it. We take it very seriously, and we think everything revolves around it. There is nothing so reprehensible and unimportant in nature that it would not immediately swell up like a balloon. Everything in nature thinks everything revolves around it. So we think that the world revolves around our minds. And just as every porter wants to have an admirer, we want that we control everything. We want to understand everything. So even the proudest of men, the philosopher, supposes that he sees on all sides the eyes of the universe telescopically, focused upon his action and thought. We think that everything revolves around us, and that is arrogance. That comes from a place of arrogance. And where does this arrogance come from? It comes from Amalek. It comes from Haman. What is Haman's defining line in the Megillah? Now we're getting back to the upshot of everything I want to talk about. What is the defining characteristic quality of Haman in the Megillah? If that Haman says, "Vayomer Haman, b'libo l'mi yachpot ha-melech la'asos yikar yoser mimeni." That Haman says in his heart, who in the world would the king possibly want to do good to more than myself? Everything revolves around him. The king Ahasuerus says to Haman, what should I do to the person who I fancy, who I want to give kavod to honor, to glorify? And Haman automatically assumes, who could that possibly be? Me. I'm the person he must want to give honor to. That's why the gematria of a Amalek is both Ram, haughtiness, and Suffolk. Because now listen very closely, even if you've been spacing out, but this is the upshot. When we take our minds too seriously, when we take this tool of human reasoning, of proof, of back and forth, of question and answer, when we take that to be the sole decider of truth, the sole decider of what we should believe and what we should engage in, then we are being arrogant and we will have many, many doubts. We will be crippled with doubts. We will be severely limited by our doubts. Because there are not answers. My approach to Emunah is this, exactly. Not that we shouldn't look for some answers, not that we shouldn't look for justifications. Books like Permission to Believe, Permission to Receive, these books are very good to give you justifications. But you will always have many questions on them. They will not give you foolproof answers. But the upshot of all of this is that you are very foolish, very nearsighted. You are very arrogant if you think that you need answers. Living with questions is okay. I have so many questions. Living with questions is okay. Having a question doesn't mean you can't engage, doesn't mean you can't believe. There's no reason you should assume that you should be able to have an answer. Why does there have to be an answer to something? We've shown human reasoning doesn't actually make sense in the first place. It's a leap of faith that we do this whole thing called questions and answers. It's okay to have questions. It's okay to have unanswered questions. I have many questions, but I engage in a deep, meaningful religious life despite those questions, because I don't expect there to always be answers. I still look for justifications. I look for ideas. I look for answers that make sense, but not answers that are foolproof. This is the defeat of a malik. The defeat of haughtiness is the absolution, is that a word? Absolving of doubt. Okay? Now I just want to look at a few, very quickly, a few lines from some of the philosophers we saw. What time is it? Maybe we should skip this. We're just going to go to the third one, because this last one right here, on the bottom. More than just the fact that it's okay to live with questions, what I want to impart to you is that not only is it okay to live with questions, but questions and doubt and not knowing, for me personally, and like I said to you in the beginning, this is what I'm giving over to you right now is from a deep place in my life. This is the inner recesses of my religious identity, of my religious life. And one of those things is the following statement. Do we know what that is?
Use your Kabbalah.
I'll go see what's going on.
There is a peeping
noise outside.
Yeah. Where's the
scotch? Oh no. Turn it back on?
Wait,
what happened?
That went off at that time? So, not only is it okay to have questions, not only is it the fact that you don't have an answer, not only should that not mess up your ability to engage and your ability to believe, but for me personally, this is, like I was trying to say, this is coming from a very deep place inside of my life. For me personally, having doubts, having questions, is actually one of the highest places of my faith. Because in our doubts, in our unsolvable doubts of this world, of our inability to make sense of this world, forget religion for a second, of our inability to make sense of this world, in that moment, listen very closely right now. Guys, I love your coffee, but try it. In that moment of experiencing doubt, of experiencing the inability to solve problems, we experience and we meet our limitation. In that moment, we confront the fact that humans are not God. We confront the fact that we have limitations, that we are weak. We are powerful and we are weak. And in that moment, the presence of God, the ability to engage in belief becomes the most powerful force in the world. Guys, really try. It's just hard for me to concentrate. Try and stop talking. You don't have to listen. In those moments, I experience deep, deep faith. Because when we find those moments, those places of not knowing, of realizing that the human mind actually cannot solve this, cannot make sense of this, there we see the fact that we are a creature. We are created. We are not the creator. In those moments, we realize that there's something much beyond us, something far greater than us. And to fall into the open arms of that being in those moments of doubt and helplessness, if you're functioning in the realm of intellect, is absolutely sublime, is beyond powerful. And that's exactly what this amazing psychologist, he's actually Jewish, but I don't think he was from, I mean, he wasn't, this amazing author, Eric Fromm, he wrote an awesome book called The Art of Loving. You should all read it, especially before you get married, or once you get married, whatever, at any point. He writes the following. Listen closely. the experience of union with man, or religiously speaking, with God, the experience of having union with God, is by no means irrational. On the contrary, it is, as Albert Schweitzer has pointed out, the consequence of rationalism. Having union with God, belief in God, is the consequence of rationalism. Three lines from the bottom, its most daring and radical consequence. It is based on our knowledge of the fundamental and not accidental limitations of our knowledge. It is the knowledge that we shall never grasp the secret of man and of the universe, but that we can know, nevertheless, in the act of love. It is in those moments that we realize our limitations, that we find that there's a secret to the universe. So, really, that, we have 12 minutes left. That is all the first part of this, in a very condensed version. Now that I've tried to show you that intellect is just one tool, and that it's a very severely limited tool, I want to now speak about what are some of those other tools. Where does our faith come from? Aside from what I just spoke about the doubt giving birth to faith. Where does our belief come from? Where does our faith come from? So there's a lot to say. Like I said, this is like a year's worth of shiurim that we're trying to put together. And that was all just the intro. That was just the setting the stage for the following. But we're just going to speak a little bit. We're going to skip the first one, and we're going to go to the second one. So experience. There's an amazing story of the Baal HaTanya, that there was this incredibly well-populated town of scholars. There was a town called Shklov, which apparently had a lot of Talmidei Chacham, a lot of brilliant scholars living in it. And the Baal HaTanya was passing through, and a lot of them did not hold of what he was teaching. They didn't really like his methodology. They were misnagdim. And they came to the town square when he came by with questions. He was known as a huge genius, so they wanted to ask him questions, some of them genuinely, and some of them wanted to slug him up. They wanted to show that he didn't really know what he was talking about. So everyone came to the town, and they started asking him questions. So he took question after question before he answered anything. He took question after question after question after question, and when he took all the questions, he stopped and he paused, and he closed his eyes, and he entered into a blissful trance, to a very elevated place, and everything around him stood still and was completely silent. And he entered into this place of unbelievable union with God, and he started singing a niggun, started singing a song, slowly, deeply, in a rich, deep, deep way, started singing a song. And when he finished singing the song, he said, "No." So ask me the questions again. Ask me the question. Who has a question? And nobody had any questions anymore. Nobody had any questions anymore. All the people there said that in that moment, while he was singing, the questions in their minds started to fade. They started to blur. They started to become entirely irrelevant. Now, this sounds just like a crazy, interesting Hasidic story. There's actually something incredibly insightful and deep about this. And the idea is the following. When you are with something, when you experience something, when you're talking to something, to someone, you don't need to start questioning and thinking about that thing, about that person. Questions of how do I know this thing exists? Why do I believe this? How do I justify this? It's not that you have answers, that those questions become entirely irrelevant. They become something of the most stupid waste of time that you could possibly engage in. They feel ridiculous. The Rav gives an analogy to a bride holding her groom in her hands. Would she ever in that moment of union, of tangible closeness, of being with someone, in that moment start thinking about, yeah, but how do I know that my groom exists? You would never start thinking like that. David Hume, the philosopher we spoke about before, pointed out there were philosophers who back in the days tried doubting their existence. So he had an unbelievable joke he pointed out. He said, the philosopher sitting in his study, writing about how nothing else in the world exists, is he actually doubting the existence of the pen he's writing with? No, it's impossible. We can doubt our existence. We can talk about our existence. But when we're in existence, we can't doubt it. When we're with something, when that thing is alive, it's us. It's alive and tangible and real and animated. It's in our life. There's nothing to talk about because you're talking to, you're with. He also had another joke. There was one philosopher who wrote a paper called Why There Are No People. So Hume's question was, if there are no people, who are you writing for? Right? You can talk about these things, but you can't actually doubt these things. In our religious lives, we need to cultivate and create experiences in which we are with God. We are with religion. Religion is alive for us. It's not something we think about. It's not something we question and answer and talk about. It's something we talk to. God is something we talk to. We are in a dialogue with God. We are in a union with God. We are like the bride holding her groom. That is us with God. You take 3 steps into Shemoneh Esrei, you are with God. You open the Gemara, you experience a moment with God. Religion is made up of experiences of deep personal union with God. And you might say, yeah, but how do I believe that that's true? But it's no less of a leap of faith than anything else in the world. To think otherwise is arrogance. That's the point we're trying to get at. We are trying to look for experiences to be with God. I'm just going to read I'm going to read a quote to you from the Rav. The Rav captured this amazingly. And he wrote like this. He wrote like this, and we have 6 minutes left, okay? So just try and stick with me. The Rav wrote like this. There is besides discipline, which the elderly, wise father teaches the young, talented child. The Av Zakein teaches the Yeld Zakunim, the father teaches the child something else, something other than discipline. And this is the romanticism of Judaism, or the romance of Yadus. Yadus is not only discipline. We start with discipline, yes, but we conclude with teaching the child something my Melamed, my teacher, who was a Chabad teacher, taught me. How to experience Yadus. How to feel Yadus. The Jew is supposed to not only know what Yadus stands for, to possess knowledge of Yadus, but he's called upon to experience Yadus, to live Yadus, to engage in a romance with the Almighty, with God. One must not use words. Words cannot explain. But a funny medium, silence. The Melamed of old knew how to pass on without saying a single word, because we're not talking about something. We're not talking about an abstract concept. So we don't even need to talk about it. We just experience it together. We experience it together. The Rav says it's like a disease. A scholar could be presenting a brilliant discourse on the disease. An unbelievable PhD researcher of a certain disease could be talking about a disease. Does he transmit the disease to the people listening? No. How does the disease get transmitted? Through contact. Through contact. How do we engage in Yadus? How does Judaism become real to us? What does our emunah come from? Our emunah does not come from talking about Judaism. It comes from being in Judaism. It comes from experiencing that moment of blissful union with God. This is what the Beis Yaakov and Ishmael says. How did Bnei Yisrael defeat Amalek? They put their hands over their heads. Hands represent action, engagement, being with something, doing something, throwing yourself into it, over their heads. Heads being this place of intellect, of seichel, of reasoning, of questions and answers. We defeat Amalek, we defeat the haughtiness of thinking that the whole world revolves around their intellect. We defeat that, we defeat the doubt by diving in, by experiencing it. Not by talking about it, but by being with it in the most real and powerful way. And we'll end with this quote, and then we're going to tie it back into Purim in 2 minutes and close. When I hear people say they have no religious impulse whatsoever, I always want to respond, really? You've never felt overwhelmed by and in some way inadequate to an experience in your life? Have never felt something in your staking a claim beyond yourself? Some wordless mystery straining through word to reach you? Never? The only way you would have never felt something like that is if you're so entirely wrapped up in the world of reasoning and by your phones and by the things that distract you all the time. But if you take a minute, once in a while, starting tonight, to seclude yourself, to go on your own, maybe with a little music, go to the Kotel. We're so close to the Kotel. Go to the Kotel one night by yourself with your iPod and listen to some music.
and sit by the Kotel. Sit with the Kodesh Baruch Hu. Experience God. You want to talk where we get Emunah from? Not by looking in these books which give us questions and answers. It's by going and experiencing God. Creating moments of experiencing God. It could be with friends. It could be by learning Gemara. None of this means not to do those things, but it means you do them in a wholly different way. It means that when you open the Chumash and you read Vayomer Hashem, you jump out of your seat because God just spoke to you. There's a story, I forgot which Rebbe, but it says every time he got in the Torah, Vayomer Hashem, he jumped out of his seat. Vayidaber Hashem. Remember the Ishbitzer? You made that. Huh? Rav Zusha, Shkoyach. Yes, that's actually, thank you. Yeah, he jumped out of his seat. Who said that? Awesome. Such a straight face. Like Rav Zusha probably had. He jumped out of his seat. God's speaking to me, right? God's speaking to me. We experience a communion with God. And then the questions just fall. We don't have answers to them. They just become stupidly irrelevant. Foolishly irrelevant. And this, there's so much more to say, but this is the idea of Purim. This is why we drink on Purim. This is what it's all about. Because on Purim, we get to a point, Meretz Hashem, we get to a point where we don't even know the difference between right and wrong anymore. We don't understand, we can't even engage in reasoning. We can't engage in a process of what makes sense, what doesn't make sense. This is Mordechai and he's blessed, and this is Haman and he's cursed. We are in a place beyond that. We are so far high above that in the elevated worlds of experiencing God that we no longer even care to talk about God because we're with God. And this is exactly what the Baal HaTanya teaches us, and with this we'll close. Va'al pi zeh yuvan ma'amar hazal, with this understanding of everything we just spoke about, we can now understand what Chazal teach us. Chayiv inish lebesume bepuraya, that a person is given the commandment to get intoxicated on Purim. So drunk, ad lo yada, that he doesn't even know the difference between Haman and Mordechai. Why? Shesimchas Purim atzuma v'yaseirah mehasimcha shebiyomtov. Purim is unlimited simcha. On Yontif we have simcha, but we're given certain boundaries, certain gvul, certain ways to have simcha. But on Purim, the simcha just blasts through. You just explode. There's no boundary. There's no guidelines. You just do whatever the heck you want. You're just in a place of utter bliss out ecstasy. Hainu, shemamshichim biyom tov tosefes or v'gilim milamalim eshtalshos p'seir eshtalshos. Okay, on Yontif, the light of energy of simcha comes down in a very contracted way. It's in a certain guideline. And therefore, on Yontif, we experience joy in a certain specific way. However, and with this we close, Masha'ein kein simchas Purim. Not true on Purim. Shehasimcha gedola yoser lemala mehadas. The simcha we experience on Purim is the simcha of being freed from the bondage, freed from the arrogance, freed from the chains and the shackles which hold us down from experiencing God. Experiencing real religion in a way that gives us this total bliss, this total unbelievably satisfied purpose and fulfilling existence in this world through religion, through communion with God. Usually during the year we're held down by our minds. We're in shackles, we're bounded by our minds. But on Purim we're free. All the chains open, we're let loose to just elevate upwards. We're let loose from that arrogance that leads to doubt. And on Purim, it's ad lo yada, to a place beyond knowledge. It's a knowledge beyond knowledge through which we commune with God, which is with God. We don't have to talk about God, we're with God. So I bless all of you and myself and all of Klal Yisrael that we should experience in this Purim a total breakthrough of all the bondage that we have in our lives of the arrogance of intellect. And go home and think about this. If you don't think about this after, it's not going to mean something. These are deep ideas. But we should be freed from the bondage of haughtiness, which leads to doubt, and just experience being with God in an unbelievably transformative way. Thank you very much.